And welcome to the show. You know what time it is? It is 2 o'clock, right on the dot. It's time for Torn Into, your show for news, information, and more. Hi, I'm your host, Gregory T. Roberts. On this day, my co-host, Pastor Melvin Burns II, the twins. We would like to thank you for watching or listening to the show. Just to do some housekeeping, how about our sponsor first?
Again, we're delighted to announce our sponsors for this week's show. Bishop Custom Series for your wide range of needs, custom services. And also, Visit Tanzania is sponsoring our show today.
You too can be a sponsor. Just get in touch with the radio station. 231-727-5007. That's for Lady J. And you too can sponsor this incredible show of news information that goes across the world. Just to let you know, if you are driving and you would like to guess 103.7 to beat or M106 Facebook site, and our shows repeat themselves, don't forget the Emoji app or YouTube as well. And also, just a lot of things on our heart. We lost two great men this week.
And, yes.
To the Pastor Poole family, to the family, our condolences. And he's a great man.
Yes, indeed. Tremendous legacy.
And then they said there are a few fathers in the faith there. Williams, to the Williams family.
Yes.
With that said, weather forecast.
Okay. Beautiful sunny day out today. We have a high of 80 degrees today. Tomorrow, again, another sunny July day, low 61, high of 82. Sunday, expect a cloudy day, low of 64, high of 83. Low 70, high 83. Tuesday and Wednesday, partly cloudy, low of 70, high 82. And Wednesday, low 68, high of 85. Then rounding out the week, next Thursday, Sunday day, low 69, high 86.
And as you know, we do cover politics. and it's been, we've been doing news information and more. We're going to be interviewing the candidates, but a lot of things have happened this weekend. It started with last Sunday, our president stepping
it. No, not overly. I said, you know, Biden's just not one of those guys that likes to quit. I just stay in the fight. And of course, by Sunday, things have changed as they do.
And so I'll take on the role. And it's important that we explain the process.
Yes.
To bring up that information and talk to us about what we have to talk about. And the second half, oh my gosh. Excuse me. Project 2025. People talk about all these things. Put your hands together for the professor, David Taki Taki. Welcome to the
Thank
show.
Thank you so much, Greg. Thank you, Pastor. Good to see you guys. Good to be back with you.
Great to be with you. We have some, we need you to explain this to our listeners.
I'm happy to do so. So if we are starting with the process that Vice President Kamala Harris has to go through in order to And this can get really confusing because what you really have is you have different. We're used to voting in our elections, right? Our general election that is organized by the state. It is, you know, part of our core. That's how we actually choose people to serve in office. The parties from amongst their number, right? If you've ever heard the candidates for chosen, right? Imagine a whole bunch of old, normally white guys smoking cigars going, ah, we'll give it to Billy this time, right? That in some ways is the way that used to happen. As the country got more conservative voice, those parties started trying to reach out into the community and create systems by which those decisions would be made by further extending out even beyond the party to private citizens who didn't have an affiliation with the party, but who people kind of wanted to know what their thoughts. It's important to note that that same process that happens during our primary elections looks like another vote, right? We go in, we vote at the same place, we vote for a general election. But normally if it processes of a political party as they make an internal decision about their candidates. That's very different, and it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. The parties create their own rules by their own charters, and if they were to decide back to the smoke-filled room, they technically could do that, right? That's within their rights as a political party. So once you wrap your head around that, then we can talk about delegates that get proportioned across the entire country. And it's basically based off of population and the way that people are distributed across the country. Each state gets a certain amount. And if that looks a little bit like electoral, and so the Democratic National Committee gives the states themselves the power to determine how the individual delegates are selected.
Okay.
And that can vary a little bit from state to state, but most of them do so at what's referred to as their state party convention. Okay. And again, things can vary a little bit. You can have district level elections where people go, I want to be the delegate for the Democratic Party in this area, or I want to be the delegate for the Republican Party. And that can, you know, have a vote normally during the presidential primary where you actually choose the delegates themselves. But for the most part, what happens is people who want to be a delegate submit their name to the party. Normally, they have to be a member of the party in order to be a delegate. And they pledge their support to one of the candidates. Mm-hmm. Now, in this case, only President Biden was really a candidate for the Democrats this time around. But you can imagine if there was a competitive primary where you had five or six candidates, you might have, you know, Hillary delegates and Bernie delegates and delegates for Barack Obama and delegates for Joe Biden who all go, that's who I believe in. And in Michigan, we have what's called a binding primary. So everybody goes in and they say, I want to support these people. But when the actual primary election happens, in this case, ours was back in February, people will come in and they will cast their ballots for one of the presidential candidates. And what that does for the Democratic Party in Michigan is it basically says, okay, Joe Biden won the Michigan primary, so the Democratic Party, to be a delegate for Joe Biden, those 130 people, those are now the delegates for Michigan, right? All the ones who came in supporting Bernie or Hillary or Barack, those would just not get the chance to be delegates that year. The Biden delegates become our delegates for the Democratic National Convention.
Okay.
Right. So that happens all around the country, a little bit of variance, right? But we end up having about 3,949 delegates.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So normally what would happen is, in this case, Biden would you know, who swept up, I think he got something like, you know, 95% of all the delegates, and some other ones, you know, did win here and there. But normally that would go to the convention and we'd see the big scene everybody's used to seeing where, you know, they stand up and, yeah, we're from Michigan. We pledge 127 delegates to Joe Biden, right? You know, however that works.
Yeah.
Well, now Joe Biden stepped out of the race. And that has created, you know, the possibility of a brokered convention or something else going on. Mm-hmm. What happens when that happens is that those candidates are normally, like I said, they're bound, at least on the first ballot, to vote for Joe Biden. But now, technically, they're not bound to vote for anyone specific.
Okay.
Right? So one version of this would be that you'd get to the vote and they could look amongst everyone who is qualified as a candidate and decide who they want.
Mm-hmm.
That process right now is designed to happen on August 7th or by August 7th. And that one's a little bit weird. But at the end of the day, we'll get into why it's August 7th and how that's going to work. But at the end of the day, whoever gets a majority of those now uncommitted delegates would become the Democratic nominee for president.
Right.
That's the mechanics of the system. It still comes back to the delegate vote. But there's some things to kind of consider here, because those delegates were people who were effectively chosen because they wanted Joe Biden.
Right.
And Joe Biden, so we've seen in the recent days that the Harris campaign has reached out to a lot of those delegates. And it looks like more than a majority of them have vocally said, so it doesn't look like we're going to see a brokered convention. It doesn't look like we're going to see major competition for the nomination moving forward. Any candidate who did want to compete still can. In fact, declaration of candidacy. Mm-hmm. And they've got to meet a few requirements. They've got basically, they've got to meet the requirements for presidency, right? You've got to be, you know, a citizen of the United States, at least 35 years of age, you know, a natural born citizen, things like that. You've got to be a member of the Democratic Party. And they have to have at least 300 of those delegates digitally sign up. No more than 50 mm-hmm. of those delegates can be from any one delegation. So it's not like one person in California, which has a bunch of delegates, could just get California delegates to put them on. They have to have delegate support from around the country.
So, okay.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, by all means.
So do you think that's part of, we're getting feedback, but Joe Manchin jumped out. Well, I guess he's going to jump back to Democrat. Do you think that's part of what he looked at real quick and said, maybe I don't have the numbers I think I have?
Yeah, I don't think he would have the support. And unless he immediately re-registered in a way to make himself eligible for the ballot, I don't think he would qualify as a member of the party because he specifically removed his membership just a little while ago. Now, I have to review the rules, but normally there's a date, right? There's a date in there saying you have to be a member of the Democratic Party before this date to qualify as a candidate. So I don't know that he would qualify. Or could qualify at this point. And then again, I don't know if he would get 300 of the 4,000 from multiple states around the country to say, yeah, we know we want to see Joe Manchin be our candidate. I don't think that would happen.
Professor, why is it so to explain to people how important this process is?
The government, in one way or another, as many of us has experienced, and there is a tendency for people to either be like, well, I'm not political, and they wash their hands of it, or they have big, this delegate process and things like, you know, as we'll see later on, the Electoral College, because they're not easy to understand, but they are vitally important. Okay. And if you don't know the difference between a delegate process or a superdelegate or an elector, this doesn't matter. You know, my voice doesn't count. And they're just going to do what they're going to do anyway, so I'm going to stay home. Right? Unless you understand how the systems work, your power as a citizen to affect those systems. Mm-hmm. So it is vitally important and you know, really, really, really powerful for people in any community, but especially communities that have needs that are frequently unmet by government.
Hello.
To understand these processes and use the power they have.
Right.
Because if you don't use that power, someone else gets to use it.
Please say that again, because I think people do not understand. By staying home and not getting involved in the process, that you're really missing out.
Yeah, right. And this is what I believe very, very strongly and is represented in the math and the way the system works. Your power is used in every election, right? Mm-hmm. Your authority to either approve or disapprove something gets used in every election. The only question is whether or not you use it or you let somebody else use it.
Okay.
That's the only question.
Wow. Because that's good.
If a measure goes before the people for an official vote and three people show up, two people vote in favor and one person votes against, that measure passes and becomes just as binding a law as if everyone showed up and it passed by, you know, 1,000,000 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It does not matter the margin. What matters is what that final result is. So if you stay home, you are essentially telling everybody who shows up, you guys decide for me. And the people who tend to show up more often than not are the people who are either the most kind of polarized or the most passionate or who have the most to gain, depending on what's going on. Right. So that idea of empowerment and understanding what's going on so you can participate in these decisions so that the things that happen are actually more representative of the whole community and not just the people who are the most mad or who stand to gain the most is a vital part of both civic education and democracy in the United States.
Let me ask you a question, because you said sure. The people that need it the most. Why is it that you think that the people that need it the most usually stay home, and the people that are, like you said, passionate,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to just use the city of Muskegon, right. The people that are passionate control what happens to people in the city and other wards and whatever that need more, but stay home.
I'm going to say there's two big variables that in my experience make a difference. The first one is where my career has been focused, and that's knowledge, right? If you don't understand what's going on, if you're not paying attention, if it's how to make things work, then you're not going to participate, right? It's oh yeah, there was a vote that happened last Tuesday. Oh, I missed it. Oh well, right? You know, there's a certain degree of knowledge and capacity and experience you need to really do this well. And I personally believe that there are big chunks of our system of education that fail people across the board. Mm-hmm. But that failure kind of experience your parents have, frequently communities that are already marginalized are even, it's an even harder climb to get to that level of skill for those communities, right? So knowledge is part of it. The other part of it is really experience, because if you are the type of person who has, you know, seen government do good for you, right, and understand how that works and have the experience of being able to kind of get in there and move something to change something and have it impact you in a positive way, then that makes you more likely to go back, right? You see the actual way that those things work. Mm-hmm. Frequently, especially in the communities that are more isolated and more marginalized or have been historically oppressed in one way or another, that experience isn't there. If anything, government feels like it's always coming and taking from you, or it's limiting you. It's a barrier, not a tool.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you combine an absence of knowledge with what's really an absence of faith that this process can work for you.
Okay.
A lot of people just, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do. I'm going to stay home and then nothing's going to change. Mm-hmm. And then nothing does.
Right.
Well, that's right.
Okay. So kind of going back to our overall theme about this. So I was reading an article earlier today, and it said 48 states say there's no problem with getting Kamala Harris on the ballot. Two say there might be some issues.
Yep.
The statement to counter rain is, as of right now, the Democratic Party does not have an official nominee, correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
That nominee is formally chosen at the convention, mm-hmm. with one exception, or with the potential for an exception, which we can talk about now.
Okay.
So normally, the timing of the conventions is lined up to allow for the official nominee to be chosen in time for all of the state deadlines for ballot access. And when I say ballot access, I mean, like, it takes time for the states to actually print out the, you know, thousands and millions of ballots that'll be necessary for people to participate in the election. Mm-hmm. They've got to make sure the spelling's right. They've got to make sure that everything lines up correctly. They got to test them. So there's a period of time where the states have to have, like, this is who's going to be on the ballot and who's not going to be. Now, normally, there's a little bit of fudge room in those deadlines, so that if, you know, the deadline is August 1st and your convention is August 5th, you know, that's okay. You know, they'll make an exception. And normally, the state legislatures will be able to just kind of pass an exception. Mm-hmm. And in less contentious political times, that's what happens.
Yeah.
However, what we're seeing right now is that there are some states, specifically the state of Ohio, that have refused to move their deadline to accommodate the later than usual Democratic National Convention, which is scheduled for August 19th through the 22nd. Now, that's partially because of the way the Republican convention was also later than usual, and normally the party who's got the incumbent goes second. There's all sorts of reasons why that timing got pushed a little bit. But the inability or unwillingness for the Ohio state legislature to accommodate that later date has created a problem. Mm-hmm. And that problem is going to be solved by a electronic nomination process, which is going to kick off feasibly August 1st and conclude by August 7th. Okay. So that by then, we should have an official nominee of the Democratic Party in time to make those deadlines for ballot access in Ohio.
Also, so, which explains why she has to pick a vice president by August the 7th.
Correct, because they want that to be the full ticket on the ballot.
Sure.
Right? So that's why we'd see that. But basically what's going to happen is, much like happened over COVID, instead of having that big thing where everybody actually is voting at the convention, those same delegates will vote electronically. And as of right now, that's scheduled to, like I said, begin the 1st of August. And they can go on and they can vote electronically. And provided one candidate gets, I think it's either 1,900 and change, it's about 2,000 of the existing delegates, then that person would become the nominee officially once that voting process is concluded and verified, in time for that ballot access measure. So I believe that will resolve the last two outlying states that were likely mentioned in that article as potentially being problematic. But that's what's going on.
Professor, let me ask you this question. In a year that we say this every year, but this is one of the most important presidential races. Why is it important that we get out and vote and stop this political fatigue, if you will?
Mm-hmm. I will say this. The stakes for this election are legitimately unlike almost anything that I have seen in my life as both a human being and as a professor of political science. What we are at now appears to be an inflection point, mm-hmm. in which there is a question about the underlying values of the United States. Mm-hmm. Because what we have seen in the MAGA movement and the candidacy of Donald Trump is an attempt to position a different set of values at the forefront of American society. And we'll get more into this when we talk about Project 2025 later. But the idea that a president is equal under the law to everybody else, mm-hmm. the idea that everyone's voice equally should count, inclusion and justice are important elements of our multi-ethnic society, or that we should have a realistic secular government, questions that are being tested in the United States right now. in ways that they really haven't been, at least in my life, after November, is a very, very different kind of government, with very, very different ideas and motivations, and very different. One of the reasons why we need everyone who, you know, opposes and potentially supports, you know, to be neutral about it. This election really represents the will of the American people, and not just the will of the people who are paying attention.
Yeah, but this is not one of those sexy issues for some people, you know. It's the one, not one of those exciting, like us, we understand at stake, but a lot of people, this is all hat. This is hamburger helper, if you will.
Yeah. It is hard to, you know, I guess, zhuzh it up for, you know, people to kind of get excited about it in a way that's enthusiastic and not scary, right? I have that same issue in the classroom when I'm laying stuff like this out. It's very easy for me to be like, and this is why it's really bad, but I don't have a whole lot of like, and this is why it could also be really good. Sometimes that's hard to portray.
Yeah.
But I do think there is... You know, there are some sexier elements of it, if you want to put it in that way, where we look at what we've seen in terms of some of the progress that has been made, right? And some of the progress that is in many ways at risk. You know, we've seen significant steps forward in things like representation, in steps to try to deal with, you know, climate disaster and economic equality. And the idea of those moving forward, right, of us moving towards a world in which, you know, working people have a better shake at it, where, you know, students can attend all different sorts of education, be trade education or community college or university education, without going into crippling debt, where our health system better takes care of everyone, regardless of where they live or what kind of job they have. Those are exciting things. Those are exciting things for not only kitchen table issues, but also just for the lives of the people in our community. And that is something I think we can get excited about, because one, that is possible,
right,
with one version of what's coming. And it's very, very much not on the table if we go the other way.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, I want to let you know, he told me 3 weeks ago, part one of this was going to happen.
Professor?
Yeah, the professor did tell me.
I should have kept my mouth shut.
Yeah, he did tell me.
Yeah.
Your question.
I should have talked to Professor 3 weeks ago. Professor, we saw the money get pent up. Was that the final? Was it the poll? Well, the polls, they say everybody went to Biden and showed him the polls and showed him there's no way to see. But how much, what percent was the polls? What percent was the money in your estimation?
That made Biden make the decision?
Yes.
Yes.
So I think that what President Biden saw was that the combination of polls and the combination of everything from political excitement to having his age be the constant refrain for the rest of the campaign, was not only potentially damaging to his chances, right? But could have hurt the party down ticket.
Down ticket. And that debate was a disaster.
Right. Well, yeah. And it was clearly a problem. And what I always want to point out is, like, you had two 78-plus-year-old men on that stage, neither one of which was giving a particularly amazing performance. The difference is one was slow and halting, but actually giving facts and answering questions, and the other was abusive and lying and not answering questions at all. But we only looked at one of those two things as being a disaster. That is deeply problematic for our ability to conduct, you know, good governance and politics. If one guy gets a pass on active malice and the other guy gets pilloried because he is in fact old. Right. That's problematic. But what happened after that is we saw that narrative kind of take off. And because it was, you know, I think it was selling papers and there were a lot of people who were either, you know, happy to see Biden kind of suffer or who were pearl clutching. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Is this our candidate? Right. And so what we saw was that the national polls actually didn't move that much after that debate.
Right.
Some of the state swing polls shifted. Mm-hmm. And it was clear that the degree of anxiety and concern was palpable. Generally, what happened is you saw the Trump campaign and much of the American political right think, you know, we got this, right? You know, this we're going to be able to ride this and Trump's mm-hmm. going to win. And the Democrats looked at the numbers, and even those who supported Biden the most said, you know, yeah, you know, you still got a chance here, but it's a lot harder than it used to be, right? You know, right. It's not like you're going into overtime tied and the first score wins. No, you're down 14, 21 points. And yeah, there's still 5 minutes left in the fourth, but you gotta do something amazing here if you're going to mm-hmm. have a shot, right?
Yeah.
And that was kind of the environment. And again, I wasn't in the room, but I think that in the last days of the Biden campaign, he saw more and more evidence that one, the chances of winning were smaller than anyone should be comfortable with if you're on that side of the party line. Mm-hmm. And two, that it was beginning to impact down ticket races, like I said.
Yeah.
One of the key differences here is that already what we're seeing from the Harris campaign, and again, that still has to be finally formalized by the delegates, but presuming mm-hmm. things work the way they appear to be working, is that as opposed to being a drag where President Biden was polling several points under statewide candidates in the race that, you know, that was previously set up, Harris could actually have some coattails.
Yeah.
Right. And that's for the listeners, that's a political phenomenon where people come out because they're excited about Harris. And then they also vote for other candidates of Harris's party. Mm-hmm. So they actually get a boost up compared to where they would have been otherwise, where mm-hmm. Biden was maybe starting to be a drag, right? Where people would be like, ah, I'm not going to show up because I can't vote for either one of these old guys. And therefore, votes that would have supported Democratic senators and House.
Yeah. Real quickly, because we want to get to Project 25. Mm-hmm. Biden wants to take his war chest and transfer it over to the vice president, and former President Trump is trying to stop that. Number one.
Sure. So to avail myself of, there's really no legal argument that can be stopped. And in fact, it's already happened, right? And that is, right, those funds were raised for the Biden-Harris campaign. She is part of that. Mm-hmm. Now, anything Trump could do to deny, you know, Kamala Harris $90+ million would be in his interest to do. And so him filing a lawsuit or filing a complaint with the FEC makes perfect sense in from that perspective. However, for the most part, that FEC investigation, if it follows the patterns of all other FEC investigations, won't happen until well beyond the end of the campaign. And that's because there's really not a lot of standing for him to challenge that transfer of funds. And especially in comparison to the, what, now close to $400 million that the Harris campaign has raised since Sunday, which is the biggest haul in American political history in this short of time period, realistically. Yeah. It's not particularly relevant, even if he could stop it. And I don't believe he either mechanically or legally can.
And then the next thing, normally after coming out of a your party has your convention, you usually get a bump.
Yes.
The Republican Party did not get a bump this year.
No.
Your thoughts on that?
Couple of things. One, much of the Trump support is pretty much baked in at this point, right?
Yeah.
Many of his supporters are not going to change their minds about him. Many of his detractors are not going to change their minds about him. And their choice of a vice presidential candidate was a redoubling of what Trump is and stands for. Right. Mm-hmm. J.D. Vance was in some ways chosen because he's kind of seen as the heir apparent to the MAGA movement. He has a lot of people who are in a pretty extreme political philosophy who kind of want to see him be the next big leader here. But he doesn't excite a lot of people who weren't already in Trump land.
Yeah.
And that can be part of the benefit of that camp or that convention is that, okay, now we have our full ticket and it's exciting and he appeals to this group and he appeals to that group. In many ways, Trump's selection of Mike Pence back in 2016 was more useful for that kind of a campaign because Mike Pence brought in a different level of voters and appealed to some people who Trump didn't appeal to. Yeah. J.D. Vance is very much cut from the Trump mold, even though he was an ardent never Trumper just a little while ago, right?
Just a couple of years ago.
That makes it hard for there to be people who before the campaign went or before the convention went, I don't know, and went, oh, well, now, yes, I want to support him. He didn't do himself any favors with his campaign speech at the end of that convention. He had about 15 minutes of what appeared to be maybe a tone shift and then went directly into his very rambling and incoherent stump speech. So, you know, he didn't do himself a lot of favors there. And again, I think a lot of that is just his support is where it is. I don't know that there's a whole lot that's going to change it. I mean, the debate didn't change it. The convention didn't change it. The attempted assassination didn't change it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know what would at this point.
Okay. I know we're going to switch over, not predicting, but analytically, who should we expect to see the vice presidential candidate for the Democratic Party?
So in my heart of hearts, I think that it would make the most sense for her to choose either Senator Mark Kelly out of Arizona, or potentially Governor Josh Shapiro out of Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be the two, I think, most likely choices. Mm-hmm. I would say Senator Kelly would be my choice if I were advising her at this point. I don't know that either of them can be the deliverer of their state at this point. But okay. Senator Kelly's military background, his personal narrative, his force of character is powerful.
And
also, you know, his wife, Gabby Giffords, and her, you know, experience as an attempted, assassination as well. I think that he would bring a lot to the ticket that would help Americans understand really what the Democrats are trying to stand for. Shapiro is also an excellent candidate. I don't know that he delivers Pennsylvania, though I think he puts it stronger in play. I also don't know how his status as a Jewish American plays in the current politics of 2024.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm picking in my dream candidate, I'm actually probably picking Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg. Not only is he living in Michigan now with his husband, Chasen, but that guy may be the best political communicator and political mind of his generation. He is sharp, sharp, sharp. And I'm coming at that as an academic. In terms of who I want making decisions for the country, he's on my very, very short list. Of course, you know, aside from the three of us. But
okay, now listen, we're at the bottom of the hour. Time is flying.
Mm-hmm.
Project 2025. People listen. You better listen up because people are actually dreaming up this stuff. It's a 900-plus page manifesto of things that people want to happen in this country. Let's bring it up. Oh my gosh, this is very important. And as you can see on the screen, they're scrolling information about Project 2025. Take it away, Professor.
Okay, so Project 2025, which you may now encounter being titled Agenda 47, is a political document generated by the Heritage Foundation. Now, Heritage Foundation is a conservative think tank in the United States. It's worth noting that of the, I think, 36 authors of the Project 2025 document, 31 are either Trump allies or directly connected with his administration, who served in his administration. That's relevant because as the details of Project 2025 have become public and people are noting what's in it, Trump has tried to distance himself from the actual document, but the document is essentially made for him and made by people in his orbit to lay out what is their plan for a potential new Trump presidency. Mm-hmm. And before we get into the details, it's important to look at this in the context, like the pastor mentioned, of the recent Supreme Court decision that effectively makes the president immune from any kind of criminal liability for any acts that are done in connection to his official duties. And realistically, depending on the opinion of the Supreme Court, could make almost any action considered within what they call the outer envelope of those official duties, therefore making the president fundamentally immune from any kind of prosecution. Mm-hmm. That is deeply problematic for the rule of law or for the idea that no person is above the law in this country. Mm-hmm. But that is part of a political philosophy that tries to turn the executive into someone who has sweeping, broad power. In some circles, it's referred to as the unitary executive theory. Mm-hmm. But many of us might consider it to be, you know, something closer to monarchy or even dictatorship. And when you have a man who is actually actively publicly said he would use, you know, dictator-like powers on a document, which is about concentrating power in the presidency and limit, kind of removing other elements of government, to potentially be designed to empower someone who has that kind of philosophy. So that's the context in which you want to approach Project 2025. It does a lot.
Oh, all of it. That's an understatement.
Yes, yes. Pretty much all of it is designed to do three core points. The first thing is, as I said, empower the executive, right? Mm-hmm. Make the president stronger. The second thing it is designed to do is to weaken the rest of the government, mm-hmm. and remove much of the many of the systems and things that effectively protect the people or that constrain the conduct of corporations. Mm-hmm. Right? That's kind of the second thing it does. And the third thing it really does is it tries to enshrine what are realistically white conservative Christian principles in the function of government as a permanent thing. Right? Yeah. We live now in a what is essentially a secular multiracial democracy. And Project 2025 is taking several steps towards making that no longer real, no longer true. Some of the things are you know, pretty straightforward. Doing things like, let me get to the big ones here. The first thing that it would do that is of major concern to political scientists, it essentially removes the independence of the Justice Department.
Yep.
Right now, the Justice Department is an independent agency. Mm-hmm. The president, if they're acting ethically, does not interfere with those things. They make decisions based off of the law. Project 2025 effectively removes the Justice Department's independence and makes it directly under the control of the president, who we must also remind you is now potentially immune from any bad acts done while in office.
Right. Yeah.
So if the president orders the Justice Department to conduct investigations or arrest their political opponents, by this, one, they'd have the ability to do so because the Justice Department would no longer be independent, and two, they face no consequences because those are official acts.
Yeah. So, I mean, so you never get Clinton impeachment, you never get Trump two impeachments. Nixon finishes out his term.
Right. We've made jokes about the idea of you know, the president being a king, and he's even himself joked, you know, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and no one could hold me, you know, liable. Yeah. Under these new standards and with the Justice Department, potentially as a branch of the executive, he could, right? You know, the president could walk up to someone on the street and shoot them in the head, terrifying as that sounds. And if he turned around and said, I had reason to believe that person was a threat to the United States, he couldn't be prosecuted about it the Justice Department wouldn't act because he controls it. And so unless you had a supermajority in both the House and the Senate willing to impeach him over that, there'd be no consequences. Mm-hmm. And even if that's an unlikely situation, the fact that that is legally possible is hugely problematic for the continuance of American democracy.
But I mean, but you, not only that, the FBI, the Department of Commerce, mm-hmm. Department of Homeland Security, everything from fossil fuel to Department of Education, Medicare, Medicaid, illegal immigration, capital punishment, mm-hmm. name some more things, the Supreme Court.
Right. So let's we look at this idea of the imperial presidency. That's kind of the first thing. We talk about the Justice Department. The next thing that people really need to start wrapping their heads around is this idea of the government as an independent agency or independent agencies full of experts who are there to do their job for the American people. Yeah. That's the way it's set up right now.
Yes.
Project 2025 would return something that President Trump actually created in the last days of his previous administration, something called Schedule F. And what you need to know about Schedule F is that normally right now, the president can't just go into one of the federal agencies and be like, hey, do you like me? Are you willing to do what I want to have happen? No. Okay. You're fired. You're out.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
Schedule F basically empowered the president to do that kind of thing. And if you look through the documents in the Heritage Foundation and in Project 2025, they want to basically remove from government and government service, mm-hmm. anyone who is not willing to essentially be loyal and assign loyalty pledges and do loyalty tests to Donald Trump. That is the effect of Schedule F, is that it would allow them to go, okay, you know, you're on our side, you're not, you're fired. You're on our side, you're not, you're fired. Mm-hmm. Regardless of the fact that these are frequently long-term public servants who are experts in their field, the fact that they are not potentially politically loyal to Donald Trump would be the reason to get rid of them. And this came out of frequently when Donald Trump was trying to do things during his first term, he encountered resistance from government. He encountered people in the Justice Department who was like, yeah, we're not going to do that. That's not legal. Mm-hmm. Right. And so a lot of what Project 2025 is designed to do is to remove the barriers that Trump encountered in his first term in trying to do what it was he wanted. And if you look like down the rest of the list, and there's a lot of it, but like reimposing work requirements for any kind of food assistance, eliminating the Head Start program, cutting safety nets for farmers, eliminating infrastructure funding, ending the ability of Medicare to negotiate lower prescription prices for seniors.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Let's take slavery out of education.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, basically abolish a good chunk of the Department of Education. Yeah. Get rid of it. Get rid of Title IX protections for LGBTQ+ students. Cut the ability for parents and parents to help in their students get education funding. So remove any kind of parent plus or graduate plus loans in education. Eliminate changes that we've made so that you can better analyze what kind of students are in your classroom so we have a better idea of how students of various different gender identities are succeeding or failing, right? All of these are things they want to do. They want to take half of Department of Education funding and shift it from where it is now, which is programs based off of student interest and to some extent to market demand, but put it specifically into programs that they like. Things like, you know, international business, which, make no mistake, is an important program to have, but not at the expense of other programs, right? And if you see the idea that there is a, you know, an interest in a very conservative, very wealthy investor class in bending government to serve them more specifically, it explains a lot of these things. Dismantling the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, which is where we get a lot of our vital data on things like weather and climate, and either spinning some of its functions out to other agencies or privatizing them so they're in the hands of corporations, and we would have to pay to get that data if it's accurate, right? These are some of the things that are in there. eliminating the EPA's Office of Environmental Justice and External Civil Rights, right? This was something that was made because frequently there were concerns that environmental decisions were being made without considering things like the impact on Black and Brown communities.
Yes.
Right. You know, the factory, we don't want to build it over here because it's going to overflow into the white suburb. But this one's going by the more urban area and whatever, you know, we'll cope. Mm-hmm. That kind of systemic inequality was resulting in downstream, you know, negativities for people of color. And so the EPA made this office to be like, hey, you know, we need to make sure we're taking that into consideration. And specifically, Project 2025 wants to get rid of that office. And you got to ask yourself, like, why? Right. What is the point on this? We created a White House Gender Policy Council. They want to eliminate that. Why?
So right? Basically, it takes, you know, this country that is the great experiment and just totally whitewash it.
Well, it changes it on a fundamental level. Yes. To serve realistically one political perspective.
Yeah.
and one agenda. Right. We do something called looking at disparate impact in discrimination cases, right? Mm-hmm. So it would actually eliminate that as a standard and make it very difficult to prove that a policy is discriminatory, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So you know, if you enact a policy, unless that policy is like nakedly racist, right? Mm-hmm. If I say thing like, yeah, you know, here are the qualifications for accessing educational funding, right? And it just so happens it's written in such a way that white kids in rich neighborhoods get more and, you know, Black and Brown kids in poor neighborhoods get nothing. Right now, we could look at that and go, hey, look, the impact of this policy is way out of whack. It's having this disparate impact. It's not cool. This is discriminatory. If you eliminate that disparate impact standard, then unless the policy itself says white kids get it, Black kids don't, you couldn't say it's discriminatory.
Mm-hmm. Now, right? So Professor, what do you say to the person that says, you know, this country's gone too far left? This is just bringing us back center, apple pie and families and all that kind of stuff.
I would politely say that that's nonsense. The impact of systemic racism and discrimination has become more public in recent years. Mm-hmm. And we have only begun to address the deeper issues of division and inequality in this country. The idea that human compassion and any efforts to actually create real equality have been pilloried as being woke and have otherwise been attacked is not in line with reality, even if it is in line with some people's political or racial preferences.
Yeah. Professor, I'm sorry. You deal with a lot of young students. When we talk about issues like, you know, DEI becoming a dirty word or affirmative action, do we mm-hmm. get younger students, I mean, that mindset that somehow they think that's put people in at an advantage ahead of, you know, I'd say mm-hmm. traditional white students. Is that the mindset that they think somehow that they have other people have an advantage that they didn't have?
It is the mindset of some, largely based off of either, you know, the familiar environment they're coming from, the information they've been exposed to. You know, there are some people who do think that. And there are good faith actors who think that because they only see one picture, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Or they get information that is partially inaccurate, or it's, you know, it's only select cases. It's been cherry picked, right, to kind of make the case that this is the problem, right? That the problem mm-hmm. is not the entire history of the United States or its baked in systemic inequalities, but this program over here that's letting this immigrant family get a business loan where a non-immigrant family doesn't, mm-hmm. right? Okay. So there are people who I think are decent human beings, good faith people. Some of my students come in the same perspective who don't have the information to see the whole picture. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's reasonable. It's unfortunate, but you know, once they normally get a better perspective on things, they do in fact see what's really out there. Right. And any program can always be, you know, reviewed for waste, fraud, abuse, or disparate impact. It should be right. But there are those who are legitimately bad faith actors in this capacity. Right, who have an active interest in maintaining their power and their privilege and their position, or who believe, you know, things that are inherently bigoted. Mm-hmm. And it is in their interest, right, to keep those other good faith actors thinking that this is a huge problem.
Okay, we got to go to the board, Pastor.
Okay.
So what do you think will happen if Project 2025 passes? And what suggestions do you offer to those who would be affected?
Okay, so let's make sure we're dealing with this in the proper context. Mm-hmm. Project 2025 would require a whole bunch of legal and presidential actions after Donald Trump was elected and feasibly got majorities in the House and Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Trump's election would do a lot because there's a lot that, you know, the Supreme Court has recently done to empower the president. But if Donald Trump wins the election and gets a majority in both houses, much of this would happen. And it could happen through a very, you know, series of laws. Those laws could be challenged legally, of course. Mm-hmm. Problem being that the same Supreme Court that has set the stage here would be the final arbiter of those decisions, mm-hmm. and might not let a lot of that go through. The laws themselves, you know, I mean, in some ways, this is a point where you've got an opportunity to vote, right? We've all got an opportunity to vote and mm-hmm. prevent the agenda from moving forward in November. And after that, I think it's good trouble, right? You're talking about, you know, protests, civil disobedience, educational efforts, right? Peaceful, nonviolent, but active elements of resistance to all of this.
Thank you.
That would be, you know, the playbook that I would turn to. And when we look at what that playbook has been able to accomplish, mm-hmm. Both here and elsewhere, I think it would be exactly where I would pivot to next. You know, do not go quietly, hold the line, you know, and get out there and connect with people in the community and rally, because there are still potentially small D democratic solutions to try to push back against it. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more work if they've been able to put it into place than it is to prevent it from coming into place. But it's not as if this whole thing is one package, right? You know, these would be all different actions that would have to be taken by an administration that wants to take them.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So to bring this home, mm-hmm. We only have 2 minutes left. To bring this home, what should we be doing?
I think, like that last comment we got from the board, we need to think about what the world looks like 6 months from now, a year from now, right? I've got a lot of people like, I just wish January 20th were here already so this could all be done and I can stop thinking about it for 2 minutes. And I'm like, you know what? I feel that too. I think there's a lot of us that are tired and it's stressed. I've seen a lot of stuff about people like, hey, can we live in some precedented times for a while? Because all this unprecedented stuff is too much.
Unprecedented stuff.
Right? And I get that. Here's the thing. On January 21st of next year, we will all either be exhausted and relieved, or we collectively would give anything to be right back here with an opportunity to make things different. Mm-hmm. Those are one of the two results we're going to see. And so, you know, what I think we need to do now is we need to take up the power and ability we have as citizens in a free republic, and not go down the wrong path and not enable things like Project 2025 from happening, and say to the world and to each other, no, you know, we are going to live in a free and democratic society. We are going to not impose any one person's race or religion on the country as a standard that must be met. We are not going to let any particular group conduct a new revolution. We're not going to just let that happen and let these things be taken away from us. We can't do that for our kids. We can't do that for ourselves. And so that's what I would say. You know, read 2025 on your own and look at what's going on and get involved. You know, the best thing you can do is talk to somebody else who maybe is on the fence or maybe doesn't have the right information. The one thing that always gives me hope about this country is that all of the money and all of the advertising and all of the, you know, lobbyist dollars, that doesn't have any power if people show up and vote.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And so that's, do that.
That's, we got to end this show. Professor, we'll be having you on the show again to keep us updated on this stuff. Thank you so much. Listen, that's the end of the show. As we say, go out and sow a seed. Thank you, brother. Yes. Go sow a seed in somebody's life. You never know who you might touch. This is Torn the Tube. We'll see you next week. Take care. God bless.